Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees. In a quick follow-up to my interview with Thomas Prenn last week, I'm thrilled to be able to report that Jamestown, Colorado, received overwhelming support for a mammoth rebuilding effort needed due to the devastation from the Colorado floods last month. Thousands of cyclists showed up on Saturday, and organizers of the day-long event were able to collect $100,000 in donations. More still needs to be done, but it's a big start on the way to bringing back this quaint little town that cyclists seem to love to travel to outside of Boulder. So in political news, Mary Burke, who is the sister of Trek Bicycle CEO John Burke, announced her candidacy for governor of Wisconsin on the Democratic ticket. There is some question as to whether Ms. Burke's candidacy could be derailed by scrutiny into the involvement by Trek in the Lance Armstrong scandal. There is little doubt that Trek benefited enormously from what was termed the Lance effect, a huge increase not only in bike sales, but in participation in the sport. And even though Mary Burke was employed by the company at the time, there is no evidence that she was involved in any of the direct dealings with Lance Armstrong. Greg LeMond sat for an interview with Anderson Cooper on CNN's 360 and had no trouble speaking his mind. LeMond stated that Armstrong would have been, quote, top 30 at best, end quote, and not capable of winning the Tour de France without the help of doping. He also says Armstrong's behavior was criminal and that Armstrong should go to jail for his transgressions. It is fair to say that Armstrong's actions helped to take down LeMond's company and that LeMond is on his way back to success today. So with all of that as background, my first guest this evening has also been all over the news in the past week or so. Wall Street Journal's Reid Albergati, along with co-author Vanessa O'Connell, has been on NPR's Fresh Air, as well as the Colbert Report, From the Sublime to the Hilarious, talking about their new book, Wheelman, Lance Armstrong, the Tour de France, and the Greatest Sports Conspiracy Ever. With two movies, so many news articles, it's not even possible to track, and several excellent books about Armstrong and his downfall, I wanted to know what is different about Albergati's take on the situation. And we'll ask him in a moment. And finally, I'll speak with Thomas Bowden. Tom is an attorney, though we won't hold that against him. He's also the head of Bike Virginia and evidently a travel-by-train enthusiast. He'll tell us about his experience with Amtrak's Ro-Ro, the first of what might become standard fare in traveling on trains with your bike. Ro-Ro, by the way, stands for roll on, roll off, which is different from wax on, wax off. So let's talk with author, journalist, an amateur bike racer, Reid Albergati, about his new book, Wheelman. Reid, thank you for joining me on The Outspoken Cyclist this evening. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Diane. It's good to be here.
So you've had quite the couple of weeks, you and Vanessa, everything from Colbert to NPR's Fresh Air. How are you guys holding up?
We're good. I mean, it's a little exhausting, but we've had a lot of fun and, you know, people seem to be, responding well to the book. A lot of good comments, so we're happy.
You think? It's already on the bestseller list.
Well, we made the bestseller list for e-books and for combined print and e-books. We were very happy about that. It's a good sign that, you know, people are picking the book up and, you know, hopefully they'll read it and they'll like it.
The first thing I want to ask you is, where did you get this picture of him? The cover photograph of Lance Armstrong, and the book is wonderful. Whoever did the artwork, and if this was sitting in a bookstore facing out, anybody would walk up to it and go, I want to read that book.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. Penguin, really, Gotham, I should say, which is a division of Penguin, I thought did a great job with the cover. It was actually taken, that photograph was taken And if you haven't seen it, it's a photograph of Lance Armstrong's face, and you can see a little bit of blood running down under his eye. The photo was taken in 2010 in May at the Tour of California. That was the day, it was on the same day that our initial, you know, big break in the story where we uncovered these emails that Floyd Landis had sent detailing the doping program on the U.S. Postal Team came out. Armstrong gave a press conference in the morning where he called Floyd Landis a liar, and then he subsequently crashed in the race, crashed out, and left the Tour of California.
Yes, it is quite the ugly little cut under his left eye, it looks like, and running down his face. You know, and there's it's an amazing photograph. It's kind of grainy, too, which I like. Not real sharp. I think it's awesome.
Well, it's a gritty story.
It is a gritty story. You're absolutely
not a shiny, clean story.
Yeah, thank you. I would agree with that. So as a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and I know that you do other kinds of reporting, but you do a lot of sports stuff. When did the Lance Armstrong story first become interesting to you? It wasn't in 2010. I wouldn't.
No,
think.
I mean, it was much before. It was long before that. I you know, really started to focus on the doping part in around 2006. You know, when Floyd Landis tested positive, and it really, you know, at that time, the Mitchell report was just coming out, and you know, doping was becoming more a part of the American sports debate, if you will. And for a long time, because I was an amateur cyclist myself, and my father had been a cyclist. I grew up in the sport. I had always written the cycling stories for the journal. So we do our requisite, you know, one story about the Tour de France every year. And, you know, usually we'd find a business angle. We'd talk about the riders' salaries or something like that. And you know, eventually we actually started a sports page around 2008, 2009. And that's when we could really write about cycling more traditionally, more as a sport.
So this story became obviously a focal point for that kind of reporting because it was, I mean, he's been in the news ever since he had the cancer discovery, really, pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, and I always thought that the corruption at the highest levels of the sport, or, you know, at the time, there were allegations of, you know, cover-ups, you know, in the UCI, and the way that these international sporting governing bodies worked was really fascinating to me. And, you know, of course the doping was part of that, but not the whole story. And, you know, one of my first stories was, we wrote about, this was back into late, or maybe early 2009, I wrote about Armstrong and Thomas Weisel, who owned the U.S. Postal Team, and some other really rich backers of the sport, had actually tried to buy the Tour de France from the Almarie Sport Organization. And I just thought that was amazingly interesting. I mean, first of all, who knew you could just buy the Tour de France? It turned out they couldn't buy it, but they tried. And, you know, it was soon after that he announced his comeback to the sport.
Wait, so you couldn't buy it because you couldn't afford to buy it, or it wasn't for sale?
It wasn't for sale.
Okay.
I mean, the Almarie family has owned it for decades.
Yeah.
And they, you know, I think there's some feeling that the French government would just not allow an American conglomerate to come in and take that race over.
Well, I think Tom Wiesel's a very interesting character, and one who has sort of looks like he has his hands dirty, and yet he's able to sort of stay out of the fray. And I'm wondering if that's going to last. Do you think they're going to go after him at all? I know he's a multi-gazillionaire.
Well, Floyd Landis has sued him for defrauding defrauding the federal government. So Landis, in his whistleblower lawsuit, which just became public, you know, this past year,
right,
accuses Weisel of knowing everything, of being fully aware of the doping on the team and ignoring it, covering it up. Of course, the allegations in that lawsuit, you know, they haven't really backed that up with a lot of evidence. I mean, I think it's something they planned to try to do in the discovery process. So as that lawsuit moves forward, I'm really interested. I'd like to, you know, watch it carefully and see what comes out of it.
That leads me to another question, and that is, You know, Lance Armstrong benefited, obviously, and was doping. There were people who benefited from this. A lot of people were hurt. Tyler Hamilton and all the other pros who have since had to retire. You've got Betsy and Frankie Andreu. You've got Emma O'Reilly. But now we're talking about people who actually made money from this and who did well from this, including people like Trek Bicycles. You know, there were people who actually did okay out of this, yes?
Absolutely. I mean, and the U.S. Postal Service certainly, I mean, they put in $40 million over the years. And if you added up the marketing benefit, that sometimes intangible marketing benefit, you know, it had to have added up to at least that amount. But what the Postal Service is saying and what the Department of Justice is saying in its lawsuit against Armstrong, it's actually part of the same one that Weisel's involved in, but the Department of Justice has only joined that lawsuit in connection with Armstrong and Johan Bernil. But their argument there is that the Postal Service, while it might have gotten a benefit while Armstrong was racing, it's now having its name, you know, dragged through the mud. And it's now, because of its sullied reputation, is really paying a steep price.
Well, and we all know that it is not a profitable part of the, you know, the Postal Service itself is not a profitable business.
No, that's for sure.
Yeah, exactly.
They could use the money.
Yeah, they could use the money, and they spent a lot of money. So there were a lot of people, I mean, who helped Lance Armstrong to cover this up. And that was something a lot of people haven't focused on either. You had other team members who helped to cover it up. You had his wife and then his girlfriends. There were so many people who were lying and cheating. And you seem to be willing to delve into this a little more in the book.
Well, I mean, not only did we want to delve into it, it's really the topic that kept us so interested in the story. If this had just been a story about Lance Armstrong cheating and getting caught, it would have been a pamphlet, not a book.
Yeah,
but
true.
because you have such a vast conspiracy around Armstrong, and because he was such a larger-than-life figure, I mean, we just became so enthralled with the story and all these unique, so sometimes wacky characters that included, you know, titans of industry like Tom Weisel and, you know, celebrity singers like Sheryl Crow. You know, it's a rich, rich story, and I loved writing the book.
Besides Sheryl Crow, whom we all know, you know, pop singer, and this Tom Weisel, who are some of the other smaller players that you sort of talk about in the book?
Well, I like a character named Steve Wisnett, and I say character, he's a real life person, but he was the president of or the executive director of the Lance Armstrong Foundation at one point, and actually left. His tenure was, you know, less than 3 months. He just took off because he felt like there were too many secrets, and he didn't like the way you know, the thing was being run, and he was friends with Greg LeMond. I thought his part of the story was fascinating, and that's one that's never been told before. He was, I think, courageous to go on the record with us and tell his story.
Well, and Greg LeMond this week had some very interesting things to say to the public in what I think is one of his very first interviews in a long, long time publicly, saying that if Lance Armstrong had not been doping, he would not even be in the top 30 riders. I thought that was an interesting comment.
Yeah, I mean, it's provocative. And, you know, the thing is, you can't prove Greg LeMond wrong, because we'll never know how he would have done without drugs. And I don't know. I mean, I would like to know. I would like to turn back the clock and see who would have won. I think the reason he could say that is, you know, doping affects different people in different ways. So when you introduce doping into the sport and everyone's doing it, it doesn't really level the playing field. It just changes the landscape of the playing field in such a way that some people are going to do well who might otherwise not. And, you know, the question is, would Lance have been, you know, a one-day classics rider without EPO, or, you know, would some of these other riders who, like Jan Ullrich, Ivan Basso, would they have been the best riders in a drug-free, professional cycling circuit. So I think it's a great question.
I am speaking with Reid Albergati. He is, along with his co-author, the author of Wheelman, Lance Armstrong, The Tour de France and the Greatest Sports Conspiracy Ever. And the other author is Vanessa O'Connell, who is not with us this evening. But I wanted to talk to Reid about this because he's also a cyclist and has a different sort of view of how cycling works. The title, The Tour de France, The Greatest Sports Conspiracy Ever, the book sort of begins with the 2004 Tour. And right there in chapter one, and then comes through the stories. There are so many facts and so many stories and so many incidents. I mean, it's just one of the most chock full books I've seen. And it's not even gigantic type, by the way. It's little type. So do you have an opinion about Pat McQuaid and before him, Mr. Verbruggen, and whether they were complicit? The UCI is just such a funky story.
I mean, look, there are so many stories about those guys. We interviewed hundreds of people for this book, and we heard everything. And, I mean, one of the things that we did, we're able to verify and we did uncover in the book, is that Tom Weisel, had an investment bank, Thomas Weisel Partners. He actually had a brokerage account. He was managing Hein Verbruggen's money. So this was actually... I mean, it was a huge conflict of interest, but
I didn't know that.
They had this financial relationship, and it was at the time when, Armstrong was facing doping allegations year after year, and the UCI always backed up Armstrong. And can we say that it was because of this financial relationship? No, I mean, we don't have a smoking gun there. We don't know what was in Verbruggen's mind. But we have these instances, like, for instance, the UCI accepted donations from Armstrong over the years, at least $125,000 over the years. So that you have these strange occurrences where there's a clear conflict of interest. And when you asked me what I thought of Pat McQuaid, I mean, he's no longer the president of the UCI, and I think the reason is all these circumstances that over the years, and the fact that the UCI never really appeared to take a stand against Armstrong, even in the face of all these allegations. And they didn't really, seem to be making an effort even to stop doping in the sport. Of course, they would completely disagree with that. They would say, we did a lot. We did all this testing. But I think anybody who was close to the sport knew that testing wasn't going to get it done, that you needed a combination of drug testing, something like the biological passport, which they ultimately did do, and also working with law enforcement the way USADA did to try and uncover the doping in the sport.
Wasn't USADA offered something like $250,000 at one point? Was it USADA? Yeah.
USADA was offered, we actually broke that in the book, that it was Bill Stapleton who made this offer. And that, I think, was another example of just the Armstrong camp, clearly not having a problem with offering money to people that, created the appearance of a conflict of interest.
You've met Armstrong. You've talked to Armstrong. What do you think he actually thinks or feels about all of this? I mean, what kind of a person, and I know this is one of those, we're really not psychiatrists, psychologists, but... as a human being, what kind of a person does what he did to people like Frankie and Betsy and Emma and all of these people? What is it about Lance Armstrong that is so compelling on the one hand and sort of disgusting on the other?
Well, the compelling side is that he was a great competitor on the bike. He loved to win. He loved to make other people lose. He was hugely competitive and used anger to motivate him, on the bike. But he was also that way in his personal life. So in writing the book, we tried to go back and look at him from a teenager, from the time he first got on a bike, first competed in triathlons, and really sort of deconstruct him psychologically and, figure out really what made him tick. And what's sort of interesting is he never changed. I mean, over the years, he, from the time he was a kid, he was so angry and, you know, just went after his competitors with this sort of bloodthirsty rage. And, you know, even right up until the days and weeks before he admitted to doping on Oprah, he was doing the same thing to the people who accused him of doping. So the guy, yeah, I mean, it's charming when you're an athlete and you're competitive, but when, you know, you're faced with allegations that you decide to deny and, you know, forcefully deny, it can get pretty ugly the way he went after people like that.
Well, I remember the one story with Tyler Hamilton at a bar somewhere, I think it was in Colorado, where he confronted Tyler, where Lance Armstrong confronted Tyler Hamilton and really kind of scared him.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. That happened. Yeah, you're talking about during the criminal investigation.
Right.
Tyler Hamilton and Armstrong ended up in the same Aspen bar, and Armstrong actually went up to Hamilton and confronted him and threatened him. And, you know, Hamilton called his lawyer, who turned around and called the FBI, who in turn investigated it for, you know, potential witness tampering. So this guy, I mean, that was clearly crossed the line. I mean, he knew there was a federal criminal investigation going on, and he knew Hamilton was a witness, a key witness. So, you know, the guy just had no boundaries, and he couldn't turn that competitive rage off.
Well, it's interesting. I actually was a bike shop owner for almost 40 years, and there's a bike shop owner in Texas who has some interesting stories about Lance Armstrong as a young man and his very first bike. So I do know that this goes back a long, long, long way. So when you were racing, I'm just going to ask you your experience of cycling, because you actually were racing. You were a Cat 2 racer. Were you aware of what was happening on the pro circuit, and how did it affect other people around you? Because if you're going to races, they're going to be Cat 1 pro races in a Cat 2, you know, area.
Yeah, I mean, I raced against, you know, Cat 1s at times. And, I mean, by no means do I consider myself anywhere near a professional cyclist. But what was actually kind of crazy is that I knew people who tested positive. I mean, there were a few people in the New York City area who were, you know, Cat 1s and trying to maybe make it as low-level professionals, and they actually ended up testing positive in some bigger races. And, you know, I always thought that was so shocking because, I mean, why would you do this? You know, why would you spend the money and risk your life, you know, risk your health for taking these drugs at such a low level? But it did. I always kind of separated the two issues, because on the U.S. Postal Team, you're talking about, you know, people who had to support their families, who were trying to earn a living and save money to put food on the table. So different than, you know, someone who just wants to win at what's essentially a weekend warrior recreational activity.
Yeah, Strava seems to be fueling that fire a little bit too.
Yeah.
So, do you think there's still more to tell about the Armstrong story?
You know, of course. I mean, this book, we had to cut so much out of it because it is such a vast, sprawling story. You know, we started the book off. I mean, in the beginning, we had Eddie B coming from Poland. I think Eddie Borsewicz, he was the first, you know, U.S. national coach from Poland, the first guy to really revolutionize American cycling and bring it up to level to on par with the Europeans and at the time the Soviets. I think Eddie B could be a whole book, you know, on his own. I mean, he's such a fascinating character. And then, you know, going forward, the case will continue to play out. I mean, Armstrong is trying to, you know, participate or maybe organize a Truth and Reconciliation Commission and get back to competing and, you know, make a comeback in his life. More evidence could come out in the whistleblower lawsuit about some of the businessmen, the people who were involved in the business and sponsor side of the sport. So, of course, I mean, there's just this story will continue to go, and I think it'll live on forever.
Are you aware of the movie that's being filmed right now, Seven Deadly Sins?
Yeah.
I mean, isn't that cool?
And there are two other movies in the works. I mean, it's a, you know, people, I think everyone wants a piece of the story. And, of course, Seven Deadly Sins is based on a book by David Walsh.
Right.
He's a big character in the book, too. I mean, he was a real crusader for the truth, I think, early on. He knew something wasn't right from the very beginning with Armstrong, and he, I think, put himself through some real professional turmoil in order to tell the story. So we have a lot of respect for David Walsh, and really, I think, give him really good credit in the book.
Well, and then there's Paul Kimmich. Mm-hmm. There are so many characters. It's true. I can't imagine trying to cover it all at one time. Well, are you happy with the results? Are you happy with the book?
I'm happy with it, but I think like anyone, like any labor of love, of course, like I wish I could have spent 3 or 5 years writing this book, and I wish it could have been 4 volumes, but we had to get the story down on paper and get it out, and I think it's a pretty good product, and I've seen that people are giving it good reviews and really enjoying reading it. So that's I'm very happy about that.
Do you have any more cycling projects on your list?
Yeah, I want to start riding more myself and get back in shape and lose some of the weight I gained after I stopped racing at a Cat 2 level.
Okay, that's funny. But I meant professional. That's great.
I know what you meant.
I know. That's awesome.
Look, I'm going out to San Francisco right now to work out of the Journal San Francisco Bureau, and I'll be writing about the tech industry. But I think I'll continue to pay attention to the Armstrong story and follow international cycling. And, if there are any good stories to write for the Journal, I want to be on top of those, or at least help the sports department write those stories.
Well, I have one last question, and that this is sort of a pie in the sky thing. If you could write the news story about professional cycling, what do you think that plot line might look like?
The news story. I mean, it's actually really interesting because you have a whole new cast of characters at the top levels of the UCI. So, if someone hasn't done this already, I mean, they should be following that closely with like a documentary crew or something, just to see what they're able to do and how they change that sport, because I know it's going to change, but it's a huge challenge. I mean, how do you change a culture of a sport to get doping really out of the sport? But cycling's always been on sort of the leading edge. Like they had the first doping scandals, and hopefully they'll have the last doping scandals, and other sports will follow in their footsteps.
Wouldn't that be nice? From, as we say, from your mouth to God's ears. Well, it has been fun and a pleasure to talk with you. Reid Albergati, he is the author of Wheelman, Lance Armstrong, The Tour de France, and The Greatest Sports Conspiracy Ever. Much good success with the book. It's on the shelves now. I think you can get it as an e-book, too. Although I like real pages and paper. I like touching books. So
yeah, this one looks nice, too, on the shelf.
It's very pretty. Yes, it will look nice.
I have a hardcover.
Yeah, and the cover's awesome. Even when you take the cover off, guess what color it is, folks? It's black and yellow, Livestrong colors. Reid, have a great evening. Thank you so much for joining me on the show.
Thanks for having me. It was great.
It was my pleasure. Wall Street Journal reporter and author Reid Albergati joined me from his home in New York. His book, Wheelman, Lance Armstrong, The Tour de France, and The Greatest Sports Conspiracy Ever, is already on the bestseller list. Very interesting interview. I enjoyed the book and would recommend it. So I'm going to take a short break, and we're going to be right back on The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
On Friday, November 15th, you can help support those in need at the Hospice of the Western Reserve warehouse sale taking place from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. Featuring quality used furniture, accessory pieces, antiques, collectibles, and decorative items, proceeds from this sale benefit patients in need throughout our area. Parking for the warehouse sale is available in the Hospice of the Western Reserve parking lot at 17876 St. Clair Avenue in Cleveland. Follow the warehouse sale signs on arrival. More information at hospicewr.org.
You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees, and we have time for a few quick news items, so here goes. Outside Magazine reported that the LAB named Washington the bike-friendliest state. The article was written by Reporter Stephen Wayne Kasika, Washington State has had really strong leadership that promotes bike-friendly laws, said league spokesperson Carolyn Zapansky. But we're seeing the introduction of more bike-friendly facilities, like physical protected bike lanes in places like Memphis, Tennessee. I won't say it's mainstream yet, but it's becoming the typical city planner is embracing. Such states as Washington, Colorado, and Oregon, which round up the top three, have always been perennial contenders for most bike-friendly states. But Zapansky said seeing Delaware and Illinois crack the top 10 is an encouraging development. So, of course, we had to look and see where Ohio ranked, and we're 32nd. So I guess we have a ways to go. So you might remember that I spoke a couple of weeks ago with Sue Knapp from OneStreet.org in Prescott, Arizona, about her bike shifter for anybody, by anybody Kickstarter project. And I was reminded that this project's going to come to an end in less than a week. So I decided to go out to the Kickstarter site, see how it was doing, since I thought it was a pretty worthy idea. I like this simple little shifter. So if you didn't hear our interview, you can look for show number 163 from October 5th on OutspokenCyclist.com or go to OneStreet.org to learn more about the project. Bicycle retailer Steve Frothingham gave us a glimpse into how the government shutdown affected the bicycle industry in an article this week. Titled "Shutdown Causes Delays, Extra Costs in Bike Industry," here is an excerpt from the piece. The bike industry likely will never tally all the delays and extra costs that resulted from the federal government shutdown that ended Thursday. Many shops lost sales as local federal workers were out of work, and many businesses dependent on national park tourism were harmed, although that was eased somewhat when some states paid to open the parks. Suppliers had other challenges, and some of them were quite unexpected. The shutdown closed the Federal Communications Commission, which must approve all wireless transmitters before they go to market. And that includes products that operate on the ANT Plus and Bluetooth wireless product protocols. LeMond LLC was preparing to release a new wireless power module for its Revolution stationary trainers when the shutdown began. Soon after, LeMond product manager Evan Solida found that his calls to the FCC were going unanswered. He said, "None of the parts are iffy. They're all tested, but we still need to get that registration number from the FCC. But I wasn't hearing back, and it didn't hit me until then." He said the shutdown delayed the introduction at a key time for indoor training products. "It was going to be available at the beginning of November. Now I'm not sure if it's going to be available or delayed for several weeks." So the CPSC, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, was running on a skeleton staff during the shutdown, only processing product recalls that presented an imminent threat to human life. No new bike-related recalls were issued during the shutdown. The CPSC also approves bike helmets and regulates whether helmets on the U.S. market meet its safety standards. Those functions appear to have stopped during the shutdown. During the shutdown, consumers could continue to submit complaints and reports about unsafe products to the CPSC website, but an official told the Huffington Post that no one at CPSC would be monitoring those reports during the shutdown. And then we also know that the national parks, of course, were closed. We have one right here in Northeast Ohio, the Cuyahoga Valley National Park. But out in Moab, Utah, which is so dependent on mountain bike tourism this time of year, Ashley Kornblatt, who owns the company Western Spirit Cycling, said that Western Spirit had to reroute several trips planned for the week when the parks were closed. "We came up with different routes, but I threw a whole lot of money sending guides out to scout routes," Kornblatt said. "It's hard to make plans when we don't know what lands we are going to be able to use in a few days." And then finally, the National Retail Federation president and CEO Michael Shea released a statement Thursday about the conclusion of the shutdown. "As we head into the holiday shopping season, retailers and consumers need stability and certainty from policymakers in Washington and assurance that the economy will not implode due to their actions or, more important, lack thereof." When consumers cut back their spending, it threatens jobs in every industry. If it's bad for retail, it's bad for the economy. And ultimately, the biggest losers are American taxpayers. Well, here, Michael Shea. So he's the CEO again and president of the National Retail Federation. So that's my news. We are going to head down to Richmond, Virginia, and talk with my friend Tom Bowden about his experience on Amtrak's Capital, I think it's called the Capital Limited, with his bicycle not very long ago. Thomas, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
Oh, happy to be here. Glad to be back.
Yeah. We haven't talked in a while. Haven't seen you in a couple of years. I promise I'm going to come back to D.C. for the summit this coming year.
Great. Oh, that'll be fun.
It will be. So back in July, I spoke with Ginny Sullivan of Adventure Cycling and Cliff Cole of Amtrak about taking bikes on trains. And they said they were going to roll out this new program, and you actually had an opportunity to participate in a real-time testing of roll-on, roll-off, which I think is hilarious, ro-ro. What was your experience of that? Tell me about it.
Well, it was very positive. I was kind of there for the ride, literally. My good friend, Champ Burnley, who is the president of Virginia Bicycling Federation, has been very instrumental in lobbying for this kind of service, and he's not alone. I don't mean to imply that. So he organized the ride and said, we take a few people along so we can fill up the baggage car. And what Amtrak did was take the Capital Limited, I guess, out of Pittsburgh all the way to D.C., and at each major stop, some cyclists would get on, some cyclists would get off, and they were testing the ability to, with the car that they had there, which was a Superliner, to get the bikes on quickly and efficiently and get the new bikes, get the old bikes off, get the new bikes on, get the train out of the station on time. And it went very, very smoothly because this train in particular, the Superliner car, which is one of those two-decker cars with the observation deck up top, has a big baggage compartment that's right at track level. So they open this big door and almost like a, like a spaceship or something, and you just roll right in. So there was no trouble whatsoever getting the bikes into the train or out of the train. The racks worked very, very well. They hang the bikes by their front wheel, and then there's a device that comes up from the bottom that holds the rear wheel so it doesn't sway. And we initially had some concern that it might not fit over bikes with racks or with fenders. But as it turns out, that's not the problem. Not a problem at all.
Wow. So it could be a touring bike. It could be any kind of a two-wheeled vehicle. How cool is that?
It could be, I think, any. I mean, there might be some outsized bikes that wouldn't fit because there's a limit probably on the wheelbase. I think you might have a problem with a Yuba or something like that. But generally speaking, it's okay. Yeah.
So how many bikes did the car, how many did they refit the car to accommodate?
Well, for purposes of the test, they only had six racks, and there was clearly room for at least twice that many, maybe substantially more. These racks mount to the side of the car or to the front and back bulkheads, and so that limits them to the perimeter. But I don't see why they couldn't also have something a little bit simpler where, maybe for overflow, some sky hooks, basically, from the ceiling that you would hang the bike from. Little bit of problem with them swaying back and forth, but that could probably be managed somehow.
That's interesting. So do you think this is going to be a viable alternative for transportation going forward?
Well, there are a lot of different factors. The thing about Amtrak that I've only learned recently is that, you think of it as this one big corporation that is centrally controlled, and to some extent it is, but there is this complex relationship with state transportation authorities. I think in Virginia we call it the DRPT. And so the states have responsibility for routes of a certain distance, I think up to 750 miles. And then there are corridor routes, and there are different routes have different authorities to answer to and different funding sources. And the rolling stock is not all the same. For instance, this Superliner car is not really normally part of the Capital Limited service. In fact, it was just put there for the test, but it's headed out west for some north-south route on the west coast. The Cascades line has had this type of service for years, and in fact, it's been so popular they're just expanding the capacity. Whereas on the eastern seaboard, many of the even the longer distance trains do not regularly have baggage cars, and so there's no room in the regular cars for bikes at all. So there's going to have to be some serious thought given to it. And initially, I was a little skeptical of Amtrak because we got some answers that were it sounded more like they were putting us off and saying, "Well, it's a lot more complicated than you think." Well, in fact, it is a lot more complicated than I thought. But to their credit, I think they really are trying to do something about it. And, you know, one of the things a lot of people probably don't know, I just learned recently, is that Amtrak is running at all-time record ridership. So if they remove seats or, you know, accommodations in one of their cars on one of these major routes that's running at capacity, they may very well be giving up, you know, giving up revenue when those accommodations are not used by cyclists. For instance, some of the cars now, they're trying to convert baggage cars, not baggage cars, cafe cars, dining cars, by taking out a table or two and putting in vertical hooks there. Well, that's fine, but, you know, then that's also a revenue source they're cutting down on, because the fewer people you can get into the dining car, the less revenue you make. So,
sure, for the food service.
You know, yeah, so the good news is Amtrak is carrying a lot of people very efficiently and really does seem to want to do this.
Obviously, for the test, there was no charge to bring the bike on the train,
right.
But I imagine that they're going to have to charge.
Yeah, I would think so.
Going
they
forward.
Charge now to carry your bike even if you put it in a box. If there is baggage service, you can put your bike in a box and put it on the baggage car, and then you unbox it and put it back together. And the ticket, you know, there's a separate charge for that. And I think it's, I'm probably wrong on this, but it's in the neighborhood of $15 for the box and maybe $35 or $40 to carry the bike. I doubt they will charge that much for roll-on, roll-off service. They'll probably have some nominal additional charge. But the standard baggage charge is pretty prohibitive. And when you couple that with the fact that if you're going to take your bike somewhere, ride around, and then come back, you're going to pay that both ways, and you're also going to have to pay for the box both ways, because you can't save the box. There's no way that you know, when you take your bike out of the box at your destination, they won't save it there for you. You have to buy a new one when you come back. So that's
interesting.
You know, that's the part that we've been pointing to and saying, look, that's just not going to work. That's discouraging riders from using Amtrak to get to riding destinations. And yet, you know, with the success on the West Coast, and of course you can point to Europe and many commuter lines, like the Virginia Railway Express is a commuter line from Fredericksburg to D.C. They allow bikes on there without restriction, without extra charge. So no one doubts the ability to put bicycles on trains. it's a logistics and a pricing and a scheduling load management question that Amtrak has to work its way through. But the good news is I think they sincerely want to do that, and I was very impressed.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because when we did speak with Cliff Cole back in the summer, and he's the Amtrak guy in the New England office, and he did explain that the offices are all different and everybody had to have, you know, sort of their own say in it, and it would have to be, you know, planned out much more carefully. I'm glad to hear that there was an opportunity to at least try it out. I want to remind my listeners, we're speaking with Tom Bowden. He is in Richmond, Virginia. He's an attorney. We won't hold that against him. He's also the chairman of Bike Virginia. And we're going to take a little bit of a turn here, because I found this to be fascinating. I watched this video this week, and I don't think anybody that would disagree that the barrier to cycling for many people is safety. And we're going to turn it into that vicious cycle, because if more people rode, it would become safer, but people aren't riding because they feel unsafe. So this week, the New York Times published an interesting article by a woman named Gina Collado titled, "How Safe is Cycling? Hard to Say." You gave a talk titled, "Driving Fast and Riding Slow, The Real Risk of Not Riding Your Bike." And it gave me some very interesting food for thought about safety, perceived and real. So tell us why statistics don't tell the whole story. You had such a great presentation.
Oh, thank you. Well, statistics never tell the whole story.
Well, that's true.
I think it was Benjamin Disraeli who said, and many people have quoted him or stolen the quote, that there are lies, damn lies, and statistics.
And I think you're right.
And that's true, because you can use statistics in so many different ways. But, you know, that's just one aspect of the problem. The other problem is that even if you're trying to be honest with statistics, human beings are just absolutely terrible at interpreting them and making rational decisions. And that's part of what I think is behind this safety issue, or perceived safety issue. When you look at the activities that we do every day, in many cases, they're far riskier than riding your bike. And I would add one thing in response to the New York Times article, how safe is riding a bike? My answer would not be to say it's you know, some number. I'd say it's as safe as you make it. You know, you can ride a bike, you can fly an airplane, you can ride a motorcycle, you can drive a boat, whatever you want to do. You can do it as risky as you want, or you can do it as safe as you want. And yes, there are some things that are beyond your control. But I maintain that if you ride carefully, and ride according to the rules of the road and in the right kinds of places, and if you keep your wits about you, it's extremely safe. And so I offered some of these fatalities per million hours of activity to support that position.
Well, you actually quoted some very interesting people. You refer to a Nobel Prize winner who shed a little light on reasons we might decide that cycling is dangerous. And yet there really aren't a lot of facts. Explain the phenomena that lead to that kind of thinking, that people will go, oh, wait, riding a bike, somebody got hit, therefore it's unsafe. And what is it about human perception that seems to be so far off?
Well, this fellow, Daniel Kahneman, who is the Nobel Prize winner, I don't know if he won it for this book, but he's the author of a book called Thinking Fast and Slow, which is the genesis of the title of my talk. And he says that we have two internal systems. One is what we call the gut feel, which is system one, and it's based on heuristics or shortcuts. And then system two, as he calls it, is analytical and calculating. And he maintains that, you know, a very high percentage of the time we're operating on gut feel. And the gut feel that is affected here is when you talk about perceptions of risk, is the one that tends to keep you alive. It's the one that says, well, it's probably better to be safe than sorry. So if you hear a rustling in the tall grass on the African savanna, it's best to assume that it's a predator and not just the wind, climb a tree and live to tell the tale, as opposed to say, well, there's probably a 97.2% chance it's just the wind, so I'll just sit here and become dinner.
Right, and for that lion.
So, yeah, so that's just one speculative thought of why our brains evolved in this way. But we tend to be affected by dramatic events. We tend to be affected by the most scary or emotional events that we experience, and those are the ones we remember. So I showed these really awful pictures, for instance, and when people see those things, they say, "Oh, but cycling is so unsafe." And yet, I don't think they think of all the other things they do that kill people every day. But there are technical terms for these effects, and one of them is called the availability heuristic, and that is that's when you know your memory is most affected by the most dramatic event, and so it's available to your memory. And then the affect heuristic, I'm trying to remember exactly how that's defined, but when they combine, the fact that you are always thinking about these things that are so dramatic, and then you are also being affected by them in comparison to the things that you don't see, makes it just more likely that you're going to exaggerate the perception of risk. And I think we, in some respects, maybe the fact that cycling accidents, as terrible as they are relatively rare, makes them more dramatic when they do happen, because people are shocked and outraged. And then, you know, you draw this totally wrong conclusion that everyone who rides a bike is going to be run over and hit from behind and injured for life or killed. I mean, I could probably give you a more concise description if I went back and read the book again. But well worth reading.
I think that's a good explanation. You know, the mundane, the things we do over and over where there's been nothing that's happened. You know, like I get in my car every day. I start it up. I drive the kids to school and I come back. You know, it doesn't appear to be laden with a lot of risk. On the other hand, you know, you see one person get hit by a bike and it's like, oh my God, that's what you think about. So I understand how that works. But the second half of your talk, driving fast and riding slow, the real risk of not riding your bike. What is the real risk of not riding your bike?
Well, apart from the fact that you won't have all that enjoyment and just the natural thrill that comes from riding a bike, the risk is that By avoiding a risk that you incorrectly exaggerate, namely the risk of an accident,
right,
you're overlooking these benefits. And you know, the estimates of the health benefits, the longevity benefits of riding a bike are ranging anywhere from 10 to 1 in favor of riding to, I think the number I quoted from the British Medical Society is something like 77 to 1. When you look at the benefits of the exercise, and that doesn't mean riding in the Tour de France or even racing. It just means just getting out there and moving your body and using your bike instead of your car. The difference between being sedentary and being mobile is huge. People are discovering this in so many ways. You know, they're advocating for stand-up desks as opposed to sitting at desks at work. That's just another aspect of the same problem. So if you get on a bike and ride your bike, and get your heart pumping a little bit, even just a little bit, a few times a week, yes, there is a risk that you will have an accident, as there is that you will fall down the stairs or slip getting out of your bathtub. But by and large, the benefit overall of riding is vastly outweighs the risk. And again, you can control that risk to a great extent. And so if you look at the pure statistics of fatalities and injuries, you have to take into account the fact that many of those injuries, I mean, many bicycle fatalities involve alcohol and inebriation or impaired operator of the bicycle. Many of them, unfortunately, are children who've not been properly instructed. I'm not letting cars off the hook, but there are a lot of fatalities and injuries in cycling that are caused by the user. And if you take a responsible approach and ride safely, then all these numbers of risk would be reduced by a significant factor.
It's true that the article, I think it was the one in the New York Times, this week, How Safe is Cycling? Hard to say, had some very interesting statistics about who actually causes these cycling accidents. And that I think our perception is, oh, one person gets hit by a car, everybody gets hit by a car. And that is so not the case, that when they were looking at hospital, because if it's with a car, it gets reported differently than if it's an accident that somebody has on a bike and takes himself to the hospital. And a car is not involved, then it has a different, it gets recorded somewhere as a statistic differently. And so we don't always look at those. We always say, oh my gosh, all these people are being hit by cars. So I have one last question before I let you go and off you go. If we could change one thing about the way bicycles and bicycling is portrayed in the U.S., now you are the head of Bike Virginia, you're the chairman of Bike Virginia. You obviously have a real vested interest in seeing cycling change in the psyche of the American public. What do you think it would take to do that?
I think the single most important thing would be just to change the emphasis away from sport and exercise, which tend to push people towards the more risky aspects of cycling. Mountain biking, you know, mountain bikers talk about how they get banged up and it's sort of a badge of pride, and roadies like to go fast. And of course, when they go fast and crash, then they get hurt more. I think if we could all just take a more utilitarian view of cycling and recognize that, you know, a vast majority of trips and a vast amount of transportation needs could be met by walking and biking, then people would start to accept it again as just a daily thing that you do, and not some extreme sport that has extreme risks. You know, I think some people almost put it up there with bungee jumping or skydiving, and it's even the way it's practiced today, it's much safer than that by orders of magnitude, but it's perceived as an extreme sport, extreme endurance, extreme speed, extreme risk. And that just plays into this risky activity mentality that we have, as opposed to, you know, just hop on your bike and ride down the street to the, you know, to school or to the baseball field or to the corner store, ride around the neighborhood and wave at your friends. That's good stuff. And nobody focuses on that. Nobody gets their bike out for casual purposes anymore, it seems. So if we could just be a little more casual about it, maybe then we'd gain some traction and have more people on the road. And then we'd get that safety numbers effect, and you would have broader support for bicycle infrastructure, whether it be bike lanes or just better designed streets, complete streets, all that. So we've painted cycling into a little corner of extreme activity, and we need to get out of that.
I think that's a very good explanation, and I appreciate it. I know that you look at things almost from that, and I don't mean this in a pejorative way as an attorney, but you're practical about it. And I appreciate that practicality. Well, so now we've learned about the trains and we learned about that. And the last thing I want to ask you about is, how are the plans going for the 2015 Worlds?
Well, they're coming along. I am not directly involved anymore. I was counsel to the nonprofit when we submitted the application and when we won the bid and when we signed the contract. And then it came time for major sponsors to come in, and they decided that a law firm with some resources behind it would be probably better counsel, and I agree with that. So I stepped aside, and one of our great local law firms by the name of Williams Mullen stepped in, and their representative is an avid cyclist, and so they are very well represented. They've raised about half of the total cost, and that's all been pretty much local money. So now we're starting to reach out to national level sponsors and have every expectation that all the money will be raised on time. I think it's going great. Hard to believe it's only 2 years away. I guess it's been 2 years since we started working on it. But it's going to happen.
Time flies.
Big. Yeah, it does.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for joining me on the show. I appreciate it. It's always good to catch up with you. And I will see you at the summit in Washington, D.C.
I look forward to it.
All right. Thanks, Tom. Have a great evening.
You too. Take care.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Tom Bowden joined me from his home in Richmond, Virginia. If you'd like to hear his National Bike Summit talk, Driving Fast and Riding Slow, The Real Risks of Not Riding Your Bike, you can find the 13-minute video on YouTube. So that's our show for this evening. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be right back here next Saturday with another full hour of The Outspoken Cyclist, and it will also be time for you to set your clocks for fall. Have a great week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.